This is Henrik Palmgren. Pleasure to talk to you again. Thank you for taking the time to tune in. We always make it worthwhile, and we hope you learn something new and have new things to consider every time you listen to one of our programs. Going to Radio Archive for much more. A year of free shows for you to enjoy, stream, or download. No commercial interruptions. When you're ready for more, have a look at a membership to help us bring you a better and continued service on all the things that we're passionate about. RedIceCreations.com, that is the website. You know that people in positions of power are mad, and the big organizations, especially governments, are getting increasingly sick and paranoid. This is all part of the times that we're in. They want to control you, want to control what you do with your life, even what you eat, and preferably they want to implant a microchip in you so they can keep tabs on their subjects. They want to control and ban your ability to heal yourself and get healthy, because after all, a free thinking, independent, whole individual that is smart and have the ability to do things on their own is a threat to their power and violence monopoly. They don't care if you're sick. Actually, they prefer that you're sick. It's better for the huge investments government make in medical programs and the healthcare system. It ensures jobs, and the bribes from the pharmaceutical companies keeps coming in, and it is better for jobs and business overall. And this is how sick society has become. At the end, what they care about is that you are dependent on them. They don't care about money, after all, they print the stuff. And they tell us we have a debt. Yeah, well, to who? The IMF? When we joined the IMF to be able to take a loan, we paid them money. So we don't owe anybody anything. This is about nothing else than control. And so, in this line of thinking, right now in the European Union, 500 million people could soon suffer from not being able to legally communicate the benefits of a food or a herb, or even use what herbs they want to get well or to feel good. And they all do this in the name of safety, of course. Dr. Robert Verkerk is an acclaimed expert in agricultural, environmental and health sustainability. In 2002, he founded the Alliance for Natural Health International. That is an active non-governmental organization promoting natural and sustainable approaches to healthcare worldwide. ANH International campaigns across a wide range of fields, including for freedom of choice and the use of micronutrients and herbal products in healthcare. It also operates campaigns that aim to restrict mass fluoridation of water supplies and the use of genetically modified foods. Through its work, particularly in Europe and the USA, the ANH works to accomplish its mission through its unique application of good science and good law. Robert joins us today to discuss the banning of herbs in the European Union and the big push for GMOs and much more. Their current urgent campaign that I briefly want to tell you about before we bring Robert on is targeting members of the European Parliament to veto the proposed list of 220 authorized general function health claims, which will also simultaneously forbid all health claims that have not been scientifically proven to standards set by the corrupt European Food Safety Authority, the EFSA. What this means is that once this list is passed into law, around 2,500 commonly used claims about the health benefits of foods and food ingredients will be banned, meaning you can't legally even communicate the benefits of a certain herb or food anymore. In the past, these health claims are likely to have made it easier for you to choose particular foods and food supplements to help you manage your own health or that of a friend or a family member. By comparison, the marketplace used by future generations will contain only a very limited number of frequently repeated generalized health claims. So, with such limited information available, it will be much harder to choose foods and natural health products based on their specific health benefits. So ultimately, this will target the next generations, your kids and their kids. And this is part of the dumbing down campaign that is going on worldwide right now, and the long-term plans of turning all of this into a prison planet. Robert urges all EU citizens to get involved with the campaign. Let's get to our guest. Welcome to Red House Radio, Dr. Robert Verkerk. It's great to have you with us today. First of all, thank you for taking the time talking with us. I know how busy you guys are currently. There's so much going on, so excellent to have you with us today.
Henrik, absolutely fantastic to be on Red House.
Superb. There's so much going on and so much we need to discuss. It's kind of daunting almost to know where to begin, but I do want to talk just briefly here about the background, because you previously were a researcher at Imperial College, and back in 2002, I think it was, you started up the website, you started up the Alliance for Natural Health, and that's been going about 10 years now then, isn't that correct? And how has it been going? How would you say it has been now for the last past 10 years, Robert?
Well, it has been a 10-year journey when I decided that working in academia was very frustrating in terms of trying to affect positive change. I come from a situation where I fundamentally believe that nature has numerous answers. We're actually this extraordinary juxtaposition when you look at science and technology. A lot of science is still, on one hand, trying to understand how nature works from the molecular level, the atomic level, even the subatomic level. And the other side of science and technology is looking at how you can manipulate and control nature and, if you like, overpower nature. And I think those two concepts are often in considerable conflict with one another. And a good example of that, for example, would be where we are with genetically modified crops. There are people who fundamentally believe that you need GMOs in order to resolve much of the poverty problem, particularly in developing countries. As a scientist, I look at that issue and I see very little evidence that GMOs are part of the solution. In fact, that's supported by a very large body of scientists around the world. But there are particular biotech interests and governmental interests, and that's another fascinating interplay, the way in which governments and industry work together. A lot of people feel that it's very large corporations controlling governments, but there's another side of the coin where actually it looks like they're in it together with governments revolving doors between the two systems, and they're creating a situation that is actually for the benefit of a very small number of people. Mm. And so where I come from, it is really trying to steer science back into a course where we can be fully respectful of nature and come up with what we term biocompatible solutions to environmental and human health issues. And often that means trying to ensure that regulatory processes that are controlled by very large corporations and governments aren't such that they squeeze out the possibility for us to, for example, manage our health naturally. And over the last 10 years, yes, our campaign has grown considerably. We now have one of the highest profiles in this area anywhere in the world. We work basically both in Europe and particularly in the United States as well. And the problems are remarkably similar, because we are in a situation where global governments and global corporations are trying to rule the roost. And it's high time that people came together, understood what we can do, because there are a lot of people out there feeling very disempowered. They feel that there's nothing more that can be done, and they've just got to go and watch the television and, you know, be prescribed whatever the doctor prescribes and eat whatever food is in their local supermarket. But we're suggesting that if you take some control over your life, things can be very, very different.
Absolutely. We're going to run through some of the most pressing issues. There are a lot of current stuff that's been happening that I want to discuss with you. First of all, though, why don't we just discuss some of the misconceptions about how things have been in Europe, Robert. I remember, when was this, back in 2005 or 6, maybe later, I remember that the World Health Organization were starting to do a lot of pressure on the European Union to let in genetically modified foods and so forth. This has been something which, you know, you've heard kind of, it's better in Europe, things are better there generally than it is over in the United States. But that's not really true anymore, is it, Robert?
It really depends what specific areas you're looking at. In many senses, the controlling system that has operated within the European Union has been better at obstructing things than it has been at liberalizing things. So in very simple terms, in the United States, the situation has been so much more liberal that GMOs have had a very good footing. If we think that it was 1996 that the first commercial GM crop was sold, and ironically, it was actually at my university at Imperial College that the first test for a GM crop was actually conducted on experimental plots, and myself and one professor were, as I recall, the only two people objecting to it at that point. But 1996, the first commercial GM crop gets sold. We now have a situation where 80 to 90% of processed foods selling in US supermarkets contain GMOs. In Europe, it's a tiny proportion. Almost none of the big 50 food corporations sell foods into the human food chain that contain GMOs because they know that we, the consumer, don't like reading labels that have this food contains genetically modified organisms. And that is obviously a legal requirement that has been hard fought by European consumers, and it means that any food that contains more than 0.9% GMOs needs to be labeled as such. Mm. What we haven't won, of course, is the battle for animal feed. So we have a situation in Europe where 85% of the compounded animal feed actually is GMO, and that is GMO soya, GMO maize. A lot of the soya has been grown in places like Brazil in, you know, recently deforested rainforest. The vast majority of the world's soya and maize crop is now GMO, and that goes straight into animal feeds in Europe. The big question in terms of human health is that do we see vertical migration between the GMOs that are ingested via the animal's alimentary tract? Does that then go into the meat tissues that we eat, or the dairy produce that we drink or eat? And it's very interesting when you look at the data. What you generally find is, yes, a proportion of it does go in. And but of course, from if you look at Monsanto's papers, they generally say that, well, the amount is not biologically significant. And if you look at other people's papers, they say it could well be biologically significant. Mm. And of course, the big risk from a human health point of view is the fact that you are consuming products that have the potential to have completely unpredictable proteins produced because of gene expression that can't be controlled. And one of the great symptoms of being exposed to foreign proteins is, of course, inflammation and allergy, which are actually rife across all the major chronic diseases that we're seeing now in Western countries. So it's one of those situations. If you look how hard it was to prove, it took about 30 years to show that cigarette smoking, when you're pulling tar and cigarette smoke into the human lung, took about 30 years to prove a causal relationship between that. Trying to find a causal relationship between the consumption of GMOs and inflammatory diseases that are right at the heart of all the major chronic diseases is a very, very difficult thing to prove. And of course, biotech companies exploit that difficulty to our cost.
Explain a little bit more about difficulty, because I think I heard even Jeffrey Smith a while back talking about the fact that there hasn't been any long-term studies. So how could they know?
Well, exactly. The point is that you've got the possibility for epidemiological evidence. What the biotech companies are saying is we believe that GM crops are substantively similar to conventional crops, therefore we don't need to test safety. They also say that, you know, if GMO crops were causing such a problem, surely there would be very obvious adverse effects. And of course, as Jeffrey Smith has reported better than anyone else in Genetic Roulette and other sources, there have been episodic outbursts of very grave problems associated with GMOs. But what we've got to remember is the fact that there are the number of traits that are out there commercially are very limited. In fact, far and away the majority are linked to Roundup resistance and then linked to expression of the Bacillus thuringiensis endotoxin that is toxic to, you know, moth pests such as the borers on corn, for example, and maize, and cotton crops, etc. So the issue is that are these crops that are now very, very widely dispersed and being consumed by Americans every day causing a big problem? Well, we still see a continuing incidence and growing incidence of chronic diseases. I mean, we're now seeing a situation where obesity and diabetes are striking people at an ever younger age. And the question is it only related to the macronutrient content of the diet, or is it related to some of the other proteins? Mm. And what one of the big problems we got in nutrition is the lack of development of particular elements of nutritional science. And while we have a reasonable understanding of carbohydrate science, you know, most people now know that they should be out there, if they're going to be eating carbohydrates, they should be eating more complex carbohydrates and not right. simple ones. Right. In the area of fats, they know that there are such things as healthy fats and unhealthy fats. And it's interesting that, you know, sometimes mainstream views on that have been proven to be very incorrect. And we've got a real question mark over the relationship between, say, cholesterol and health that is very, very active at the moment. But when it comes to proteins, which are far more complex than carbohydrates and fats, we know very little. We are told by governments, just make sure that you eat sort of 80, 90 grams of protein a day. And they really have very little idea other than the fact that they know you shouldn't burn and carbonize your protein. Otherwise, they say, well, it doesn't really make any difference where you get it from. And we know from the cutting edge of medical and nutritional science, it makes a huge difference what you do with your protein. And if it makes such a difference with what you do with your protein, it obviously makes a big difference what other proteins are combined with it. And one of the reasons we perhaps see such a range of problems associated with Western diets is actually linked to certain proteins that are common in some of the cereal crops that have now become the major part of our diet, and also some of the proteins that are associated with dairy. Dairy and cereal have become the absolute staple in the West, and they are very, very significant question marks as to whether they are right at the root of many of the health problems that we have.
There's just so many problems when we think about how we, you know, get to our food from the field or the, well, slaughterhouse in some cases, to our plates in that sense. Monocultures, for instance, is just one of these problematic areas when we begin to mechanize and industrialize our food production. And again, I think we're seeing the long-term effects of that right now. And as you say, I mean, sure, there are so many different health issues that you know, come up right now for many people in the Western world. But again, how can this be proven? How can we tie our behavior that we had for the last, 80-100 years or so to the things that are really starting to happen now, Robert?
Yes, and I think one of the things we need to look very closely at is what happens if we start to alter our behavior, or whether there are subgroups within our population who start to dramatically alter our behavior and behave in a way that's different to that which, say, the mainstream medical profession or government advice suggests we do. And that's when it all becomes very interesting, because we're seeing people who have chronic diseases that was seen to be terminal, for example, people just, their health just turning around, where self-healing within the body seems to be, if you like, re-equilibrated. The body gets back into balance, and suddenly a whole host of health problems disappear. And yeah. Diabetes, type 2 diabetes, is probably the most classic example. Many people who visit a doctor and are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes now believe that's a condition that they will have to suffer for the rest of their lives, when there are a subset of people who do things differently on different advice who find 3 months later they have no sign of diabetes whatsoever and get themselves back into perfect health. Now, why is it that that information is basically submerged to the depths, to the point that very few people have the privilege of being able to receive it?
That's right. It's so much that is tied to vitamin intake and basically to create an environment in the body where you basically enables the body to be able to heal itself from all these of all the diseases and the sickness that might come to us. And some of this stuff we might be able to get into a little bit later. I want to go back again to the European Union, if we can, and talk a little bit about some of the pressure then that's been laid on the EU and some of the people that are involved in that. I've also seen on your website now some of the latest stuff pertaining to how the EU is banning herbs. There's so many things that are going on in the European Union that we never hear anything about. And maybe your media is covering it better in the UK, which I believe they are, compared to up here in Sweden and some of the other Scandinavian countries. But let's run through some of this. First of all, the European Union. What are some of the major problems and issues that you see within the EU right now, Robert?
Well, if we look back historically, the European Union has been, you know, if we can look back to the 1700s when different countries in the EU realized that they could benefit by working together. So if you look at the wool trade was very much an interplay between Britain and the financial centers in Florence. And if you like, what we've seen is just an expansion and a development of that to the point that it is not any longer just about trying to create a win-win situation for economies. It's about controlling almost every aspect of our life. The countries that have effectively signed up for the European Treaty, 27 of them, are for the most part now really questioning whether this is a great way of living our lives. Yeah. And I think in some respects, the problems that we see with the Greek and Italian economies and Spanish economies within the Eurozone are going to be absolutely pivotal in deciding which way it all goes. In the meantime, there is still a very, very active process that has been around about 20 years in the making, but of course, historically, you could argue it goes back much further than that, but directly 20 years in the making, where pretty much everything that comes under the gamut of natural health, whether it's products or foods that we use to manage our health naturally, is being controlled at the European level and not at the member state level. So it is a classic case of loss of sovereignty. You know, if we look at the kinds of ingredients that you can use through to the dosages of ingredients you can use in natural health products through to what you can say about the benefits of particular foods, this is the issue of health claims, all of it is now being controlled at an EU level. And essentially what that means is that the European Commission, which is a completely unelected body of officials, creates a proposal, normally through very close cooperation with a small number of member states and usually a small number of very large corporations. And that goes through what is called a co-decision process, where it is then considered by both the member states and the European Parliament. And until around about 2006, the only democratic element to that equation in the lawmaking process that was the European Parliament. Until then, the European Parliament was just basically sitting there for show. It had almost no power. Whenever it tried to use its muscle, it was very quickly jumped upon. And in fact, in the first year that we set up ANH, we were thrilled when we helped create a change in the European medicinal law that was going to significantly alter the definition of a medicine so that it didn't capture so many natural health products. And in a compromise package, the European Parliamentary plenary decision was basically ruled out, and that simply required the muscle of the European Commission sitting down with the rapporteur from the European Parliament and getting her to change her mind. And a so-called compromise package, a deal, was done. And since 2006, the European Parliament has been given the power of veto. And what we've launched actually just today is a campaign that aims to try and create a veto, a ban, on a very small list of health claims that will become, if this goes through, the only claims about the benefits of foods that will be allowed across any 27 of the member states in relation to any commercial food product or food ingredient. And essentially that means many thousands of products will not be able to make any health claim, and it will create a pretty confusing situation for consumers, because they will have, you know, if you look at plant-based products, botanical-based products that are some of the healthiest foods that we can consume, the European Food Safety Authority has rejected 95% of all the health claims that were supplied. So any claims about the antioxidant benefit of, say, pomegranates or berry fruits have been thrown out based on insufficient evidence, because what they're looking for is evidence that's akin to the kind of evidence you need to prove that a drug works or at least has been tested via a clinical trial.
Yeah.
And in the vast majority of cases, people haven't seen fit to do that, because the relationship is well known without the need to undertake clinical trials.
But let's talk about the issue of control of the fundamental principle of many of these people and the bureaucratic European Union, then, in the sense to control all the aspects of life, as you said, control nature as well. It seems like the EU is doing things backward, like all plants are deemed dangerous until they can be proven to either be safe or have some kind of value, and if they don't, they're basically banned or thrown out. It's very strange how they do that. Tell us a bit about this, Robert.
Well, this is actually the principle of Napoleonic law, which is integrated deeply into the psyche of everything that is happening in countries like Germany and France that have been right at the center of the European plan, as it were. And essentially what Napoleonic law does is say that you are guilty until proven innocent. And it's in some other Western countries, the United Kingdom being a good example, the United States of America being another, we see it the other way around, that you are innocent unless you are proven guilty. So fundamentally, this is why you have a problem with the herbal directive. It is why you have a problem with health claims, because they're saying that everything that is a herbal medicine is going to be banned unless you can show that that you can get this product licensed through a what they term simplified drug licensing system. And as you know, that there are three main pillars to trying to get a drug to the market that will often cost upwards of 20 million or so euros. And that involves proving safety, proving efficacy, and proving quality. And essentially what they've done is saying, okay, we won't force you to prove efficacy,
but we will want you to prove both quality safety. And the reason we're not going to force you to prove efficacy is that it will be a traditional use directive where the long history of usage is deemed to replace the need for efficacy studies. Taking this one pillar of drug licensing away still makes it a pretty significant hurdle for the vast majority of herbal products. And it's, again, if you look at the legislative history of this piece of legislation called the Traditional Herbal Medicinal Products Directive, it came about, ironically, because of a case of medical doctors prescribing herbs alongside particular drugs in a Brussels clinic. And in that Brussels clinic, over 100 people got extremely sick and developed very advanced kidney disease, and some even went on to develop carcinomas of the liver. And essentially, the herbs got blamed for that problem. What's been fascinating is that over the years, pharmacologists have been working on this issue. There have been three different court cases in France and Belgium based on victims challenging the medical clinic. And essentially, the doctors have got away scot-free. And yet, the herbs have been blamed for everything. And it's ironic that Aristolochia, one of the herbs that was in there that contains aristolochic acids, that was actually an incorrect herb. It was effectively mis-selected by the people preparing the herbs for the doctors, which shows you why it's important to have people who really understand herbs dealing with herbs. But aristolochic acids and aristolochia have been used for centuries in very specific preparations into the longest standing healthcare traditions, Ayurveda from the Indian subcontinent and also in China through traditional Chinese medicine. And this kind of interstitial kidney disease that's now being called, Chinese medicine syndrome, had never been seen before, because they understood in these traditions that you have to prepare the herb in a particular way to largely remove the aristolochic acids. If you just take the herbs and put them in capsules, you don't overcome that problem. Nevertheless, it still seems from the pattern of disease that occurred, highly unlikely, as three courts have proven, that the aristolochia was to blame. But everyone's looking for a scapegoat. The European Parliament got directly involved in this and said, look, we need a piece of this.
So let's talk a little bit about what you see, what this means basically when we're talking about the banning on certain herbs, because as specifically said, this encroaches into the areas of, natural shampoos and creams, skin care products. It's in everything basically that those who are careful and don't want to use the chemical regular products basically. Are there a few examples of herbs that you can give us that you would consider to be very beneficial that now has ended up on the no-no list of the EU bureaucrats, Robert?
Well, you see, one of the fascinating things that's happened is that there was a very long list of herbs that included virtually everything that is in the non-European herbal medicine chest. Skullcap would be a good example. Even in the Western healthcare area, you've got only a small collection of herbs, around about 200 herbs that have had license applied for. Everything else is outside that category. The biggest issue now, because we have been publicizing our intent to initiate a legal action on this, is that it's caused real stagnation, and in many senses this is very positive, in the intent of the different licensing authorities, the medicines regulators in the member states that control this piece of legislation. It's caused them to just sit there and do very little, much to the frustration of the large companies that have been successfully getting licenses. So, for example, in the UK, just a few days ago, a campaign that is called the Herbal Quality Campaign has been launched to put pressure on the UK government to start banning a whole bunch of food supplements that contain herbs that basically these companies, and they are largely German phytopharmaceutical companies, have successfully got licenses for. And that would include things as obvious as St. John's wort and black cohosh, which are two that they're really going after. They're saying that the food supplement equivalents of those products should be removed from the market because now we have licensed ones that meet these particular quality standards. What they don't say is that the licensed products, in order to meet the standards of quality that are being set, that are really more about ensuring that a particular amount of biomarker is present in the product than actually assuring there is an appropriate quality to engender the required healthcare effect. So in order to meet those standards, they're highly purified, very specific active ingredients that are then generally stabilized in a synthetic polymer pharmaceutical base. You know, and often in addition to that, they have added synthetic preservatives to them. So in the vast majority of these licensed herbal products, there is no actual whole plant material present at all. You've got effectively a chemical extract that's sitting in a synthetic polymer with preservatives.
And Robert, do the companies that you brought up here as well now then own the patents for these, meaning that those who wish to sell these or so forth, they need to license these as drugs and pay at the end the pharmaceutical companies, or how does this work?
Well, essentially the companies who are able to get those licenses and the system, one of the reasons that we see some of the large German phytopharmaceutical outfits doing so well in terms of getting licenses for specific Western herbs largely and largely single herbs is because that is a particular system that they were using, from within the 20th century. So it's not a long-standing tradition the way in which Ayurveda or Chinese medicine is, where they were working with, say, water decoctions of often many combinations of different herbs that work in synergy with one another. If you like, the Germanic phytopharmaceutical model is just an extension of a more conventional pharmaceutical model where you assume there is a particular alkaloid or glycoside within a plant that has a particular effect. You're going to concentrate that out. You're going to separate that out from the rest of the botanical fraction, and then you're going to stabilize it within some kind of medium, which is a pharmaceutical medium. Now, that kind of healthcare, using those very limited and specific components of herbs, is very, very different from using the full spectrum of active ingredients that occurs in food or exists in, if you like, whole plant herbal medicines. And that the difficulty we have with this piece of European legislation is it is locking out a vast number of herbal products that simply cannot comply with the very specific requirements of this traditional herbal medicinal products directive. It's like saying, let's take broccoli or carrots that you find as a whole food and say, you can only sell your broccoli and carrots if they've got exactly the same and standard amount, carrot to carrot, broccoli floret to broccoli floret, of, you know, natural carotenoids or of sulforaphanes or glucosinolates, whatever actives are in those plants. And of course, that doesn't happen in nature. That nature is always a moving feast of different combinations of ingredients occurring in synergy with one another. And you can't apply a pharmaceutical model to things that are natural, that are intrinsically variable. It is that variation that's probably quite important to engendering the overall effect that is so well known with these sorts of products.
Well, all of this, Robert, is it's a reflection of the mentality of this very scientific idea of trying some kind of standardization on a natural dynamic system that they want to put into their small little parameters of, you know, what is a cucumber, what is a carrot, and everything that goes outside of those parameters on a legal basis cannot be claimed to be such. It's a very, I mean, when I listen to this, it's psychotic. I don't know what other words to use, Robert. What do you?
Yes, I think, you know, we all need to spend a little bit more time looking at the philosophy of science. One of the things that I think is unfortunate in modern society, and it's a great reason for the existence of programs like yours, like Red Eyes, so that these issues can be discussed from a more philosophical context.
Mm-hmm.
But we are essentially in a paradigm where a particular type of science is being favored over other types of science, and the natural sciences have been kind of demoted into this lowly state where if you promote or support things that are natural, you're deemed as being a bit of a Luddite, as being, you know, out of step with modern science. And if you can support a kind of science such as that which is defined now by synthetic biology, where you take elements of biology, you synthesize it, you create body parts, you play around with genetic material or molecules and put them in a configuration that nature has never seen before, so you can slap a patent on it. Well, that's deemed high science. It's more revered. It's kind of seen as the way to go to resolve many of the complex problems that we as a planet face. And the ultimate irony is, if you look at healthcare, what we see is a fairly small group of diseases, five main diseases that are the leading chronic degenerative diseases worldwide now, cancer, heart disease, obesity, diabetes, and osteoporosis, that are now all linked to diet and lifestyle. And that is a view that's been put forward by the World Health Organization back in 2004. It's the basis on which the WHO's global strategy for diet, physical activity, and health has been developed. And what they're saying is that the majority of chronic disease is actually preventable if we were to use specific programs of diet and lifestyle to deal with it. And the extraordinary irony is that if we look at the developments in medicine, we see only lip service being paid to a diet and lifestyle. If you break down the kind of advice that governments are giving on diet, actually, in many cases, the dietary advice being given takes you into inflammatory conditions such as diabetes and obesity. So we'd need to see a fundamental change in dietary advice. I think one of the major reasons why it is out of step with really where nutritional science is at is because it is still controlled by very large corporations who are desperately keen to sell their cereal products and their dairy products. And, you know, if we were to move back to whole food diets that were associated with the kind of foods that our genes have been exposed to for the majority of our evolution, hence the current interest in the Paleolithic diets,
yeah,
we can often see some absolute transformational change in people's health.
That's right. It feels like it's fairly simple, and what these people and the bureaucrats are doing right now is to make things much, much more difficult. And of course, Robert, there are some people speculating about all of this from a conspiratorial point of view. There's different incentives and reasons for doing this, of course, one being money. That's a big one, that this is about basically making more money for the big companies that already are out there, because obviously if this goes through, this will you know, create many problems for all natural health practitioners and specifically all the small business owners out there as well, right?
Yeah, it seems that one of the key goals is to try and keep people as much as possible being controlled by advice that is, if you like, top down. What the system doesn't like to see is people making individual decisions about their own health and taking their own health into their hands. And this is the startling reality, is that we can unhook ourselves from the system remarkably easily. We can decide, for example, that we're going to take charge of our own health, that we're going to stop eating processed foods bought from major supermarket chains. We're going to sign up to a box scheme, and we're going to have organic fruit and vegetables delivered to our door that are come from regional sources. The minute we do that, and we're also going to engage in particular lifestyle practices that are healthy, and we're going to take, you know, regular amounts of outdoor exercise, et cetera, et cetera. People who make those kinds of decisions then don't generally find themselves sitting in the queue of their local general practitioner,
right,
and then being forced to prescribe medicines. If many people do that, both the healthcare system as we know it, which relies on people reaching the age of 35 and 40 and generally going downhill in terms of their health, the whole system falls apart. The supermarket system is based on us basically having transferred our spend from local cooperatives where we used to spend our money decades ago to large hypermarkets where, you know, the food has come in from different parts of the world. And as soon as we plug into that system, we are effectively supporting the global trade in food, where the actual nutritional content of that food is not seen as a high priority. Making sure there's no disease organisms within that food is a high priority. So you end up buying food that has a lot of preservatives in it, that has very low enzyme content, so it lasts a long time, so it can be shifted from one side of the world to another. You end up buying spices and herbs that have been irradiated because, again, they don't want any bacteria in there. And then, again, that negates many of the benefits that come from those particular condiments that are historically, from a health point of view, so crucial to our food supply. But this is really the power of it. We can literally make a decision from one day to the next to unplug to a large extent. We don't have to necessarily do it 100%, but to do it 75% makes a huge difference, not only to our own health, but also to the system that we are otherwise supporting.
That's right. Very good point. And I mean, the World Trade Organization have their hands in all this, of course. So, you know, now we buy radiated garlic from China, which is, you know, dead and has no nutritional value left in it. It's been, many of the fruits and vegetables have been picked way too early, so they don't have the nutrients in them, and then they go ripen on the way, and they're practically, you know, dead by the time they arrive. So very, very important thing. And what I want to try to get into here before we take a little break here for the first hour of it is what's happening currently right now and what you're doing, obviously, at the Alliance for Natural Health as well, because as we know, they do things in incremental steps all the time, but there is a push right now to ban herbs, natural medicine, and even communicating the beneficial aspects of herbs and so forth. So tell us what you're doing, what's happening right now, and how we can, you know, counteract some of the measures that are being taken from the EU right now.
Well, yes. On the herbal front, we are painstakingly working on a legal action. The fascinating situation is that this has been an issue that has been considered in the past by the European Court of Justice, and just as we could make a decision to give up on the European Parliament or give up on the European Court of Justice, there are little pieces of sanity left in these organizations, and we believe that we should use every element that we can to try and create a more positive outcome for the future. So we're working on a judicial review on that. We're still waiting for particular parts of it to be complete from our end, and also certain decisions to be made from the end of various governments. So it is a long haul process. We have already raised the money we need to undertake the first stage of it, and we won't be making a call to European citizens for more money until we've completed that first stage. And we have regular news about that on our website. We really strongly suggest that people sign up for our regular weekly e-alerts so that they can stay up to speed on issues. But right now, the single most important issue, and we are literally in the next 7 days, we are calling on people to write to their member of the European Parliament. A lot of people don't even know who their MEPs are, but if you follow the information on our campaign page for our health claims veto campaign that is running as the top item on our website at the moment, you will find links of how you can find your MEP. We've got form letters of the kind of things to be able to write to them and make your opinion known. And essentially, it's one of these situations where Napoleonic law that we talked about in the beginning takes control, where any claim that hasn't been approved by the European Food Safety Authority, that itself, based out of Parma in northern Italy, has been the center of many charges of conflicts of interest and revolving doors with biotech companies and pharma companies and others, if they haven't positively approved a claim to pretty much pharmaceutical standards, that claim can no longer be made. And they've already been forced to separate out a whole bunch of claims that they had previously evaluated on botanicals, on plant products, and on probiotics, which nearly all of them were rejected. Now we're seeing another group of claims that are being rushed through to try and get the rubber stamp from the European Parliament. And the European Parliament has to make a decision on the 9th of February internally within its NV committee, the main committee on environment and public health and consumer safety. And they have to make a decision on the 9th of February whether or not they're going to support a veto, an objection to this legislative proposal. And what we're really looking for is people from all member states to write to the MEP, and you'll find all the reasons given on our website, on our campaign pack. We've got an EU citizens pack you can download as well that gives you the reasons. We've been working on this a very long time, and we see no other option than to try and achieve a block by the European Parliament. It is the only remaining way to stop this crazy piece of law actually going through.
Yeah, that's right. By the way, I'm going to have the links up to what you're talking about here. So on the website, just in case, as when you're listening in, this is no longer the top news on the ANH Europe website. I want to give up these URLs as well, of course. But again, just want to mention that this is really important, and what you've done here now, you guys have come to the conclusion this is like the only way out, basically. We have to start writing the people. And what tends to happen as well is that you get a little, it's a tug of war. That's what I'm getting here, Robert. They push a little bit, and then people push back, and then they come back with something else or the same thing with vengeance. It's never, they're not done, if I put it that way. They're not going to give up easily. This is something that people have to be vigilant about. They have to stay on top of this all the time, right?
It is, and they also hope that people kind of lose their incentive, that they get tired from what is often termed regulatory overload. And it's one of the reasons that we generally suggest that letter-writing campaigns are limited to times of extreme urgency when there are no other options. And this is one of those times. And while they will, if the objection is upheld on the 9th of February, it'll be 2.5 months later that the whole decision goes to the European Parliament. Then there'll be another vote in the European Parliament, and in order to create a block, that will require then a majority of the 750 MEPs to actually reject the legislative proposal. And that has only been achieved since the European Parliament received the power of veto in 2006. It's only been achieved once before, and that was over the thrombin meat glue that the European Parliament didn't very much like the idea that European consumers were going to be offered this compounded meat that was stuck together with effectively thrombin that comes out of blood plasma and allows you to stick different meats together. And they said, you know, if a European buys a piece of meat, they should know where it comes from, what part of the animal. And that was a fairly sensible decision that the meat industry didn't like it. So here is another object. And again, another key point really is to always understand what is the other side of the coin. What is the response that your MEP, if they don't want to block it, what are their reasons for not wanting to block it? Yeah. Of course, their reason is going to be quite simply that they have been told that there are a lot of companies out there making highly misleading claims about the benefits of particular health foods. And, you know, you create this new European standard that is requires the European Food Safety Authority to do the evaluation, you'll have a level playing field and only claims that are approved to a very high standard will get through, and that'll be good for European consumers. The problem is that if the standard was set at the right level, it would work. But it's been set at such a high level that, as I said, you know, if you can't make a claim about the benefit of eating berry fruits, you can't make currently a claim about the effects of prunes on digestive health, because today's, although that might change by the end of the year, there are insufficient clinical data to show that if you eat lots of prunes, you get a loose stool. Can you believe it? So in many cases, the relationships are so well known, people haven't felt the need to go and spend vast sums of money on clinical trials. The studies haven't been carried out. So we believe the only way forward really is to create a block to force the European authorities to review the standard, not to necessarily make the regulation go away altogether. That would be much harder to achieve. But then to bring in a new standard of evidence that actually was appropriate and covered this sort of, if you like, non-black and white nature of nutritional science.
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, what we're going to get into a little bit in the next segment as we carry on is whose standards are we talking about? Who's funding these studies? What is all this about? Because there's insanity within the EU right now, and as we're going to show a little bit later, some of the studies are funded by the people who are interested in blocking these to make even more money and to keep people sick, actually, in one sense. But let's talk a little bit about your websites right now. You have two branches, if you will, one European and one USA branch for the Alliance for Natural Health. And obviously, all of these are connected. It's not really a division per se. We're talking about specifically where we're in the realm of GMO. We're one biosphere here currently, and people are traveling, things are being spread across the globe, although we have a pervasive spreading of GMOs primarily over on the American continents right now, but it is in Europe and other parts of the world as well. So give us the website addresses then, Robert, where people can go to find out more, and also if there's a way to help you guys as well in terms of funds or donations, what have you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, the website are our front door for both the European and the US organizations, and they're very clear instructions of what people can do to get involved. We actually, one of the single most important things that people can do is to use their social networks to forward on information. We have, with both organizations, Alliance for Natural Health International, which includes our European outfit, as well as Alliance for Natural Health USA, we've got very active Facebook pages. We've also got Twitter accounts that we're regularly tweeting information. Really critical that people engage with all of that and also go onto our website and sign up for the weekly newsletters that are released both from the European website and the US website. The URLs are as follows: anh-europe.org, O-R-G, and anh-usa.org. Please, you know, if you have an interest in both sides of the pond, both sides of the Atlantic, sign up to both. We are extremely active. We are very much grassroots organizations. We sometimes get attacked by people who say, oh, we must be funded by, the supplement industry. The irony is we get very, very little funding from the supplement industry. There are many sectors of the supplement industry that don't like what we do because you've got to understand that a very significant sector of the supplement industry is in fact controlled by the pharmaceutical industry. So if there is an industry sector that effectively we work more on behalf of, it is what we term the practitioner sector. But by and large, the vast majority of our support comes in from consumers, citizens, and punters. So we are very much a grassroots-based organization, and it's one of the reasons when we need to make a call for people to do specific things like write to their elected representative or make a donation for a particular project, we often get a very rapid response, and it's why it's also incredibly useful to get out to. There is so much happening in Scandinavia, actually. We have been very involved and continue to be very involved in issues over there. Sweden and Norway have very, very different kinds of problems because Norway isn't within the EU. Denmark has a remarkably restrictive government that, if you like, has become famous for trying to claim that the amount of vitamins in cornflakes or in Marmite are potentially dangerous. It is that those diversity of views that creates such a problem if you then are forced, as the EU is trying to do, to create one size fits all.
Yes.
It just simply doesn't work when you have such different cultures, such different problems. Look at the limitation that Scandinavians have, say, on vitamin D intake. The fact that it isn't a government regulation for everyone to be taking 4,000 international units of vitamin D3 a day in Scandinavia, particularly through 6, 7, 8 months of the year, is a scandal. And yet it hasn't happened, and they're trying to go along with a ridiculous level of 200 or 400 international units, which is the same as, you know, Germany wants, for example, in a very different situation.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the key right there, that centralization is madness in this sense. We have to go back. I mean, you think that this would be an intelligent system and that the increased law text of the European Union would allow for diversity and as you say, depending on geography, depending on the circumstances of the people and the country, you have flexible rules here. But nope, it's totally opposite. It's a one size fits all. It's totally insane. We're going to talk more about that. But again, then just to reemphasize here, sometimes action is required and you need to, make a choice if you want to help to push back against some of this insanity. And sometimes the best way is just to spread the word, start talking about it. If people are aware, they can make the right choices. So once again, we want to relay people to the websites, anh-europe.org and also anh-usa.org. Go on over there, check out the articles, get informed about some of these issues here. And Robert, we'll take a short break and we'll continue with more after this time.
Thank you.
We begin the second hour, four members discussing the problems with the global food trade. Robert tells us about the bad aspects of not eating food from your region and the value of eating indigenous foods. He discusses how the global food trade has dumbed down our food supply and made us sick. Then we talk about the EU institutions that draw up EU food and medicine legislation. Dr. Verkerk urges citizens to veto legislation and inform others about the dangers of GMOs. We also discuss GMO contamination and keeping real seeds alive to maintain a diverse seed stock. Synthetic biology is being viewed as a new science to solve all our problems, while the basic principles of proper nutrition and lifestyle are being looked down upon. Robert talks about crony capitalism in our food and healthcare systems. Lastly, we end on a high note, talking about things in our power that we can do. Robert believes the tide will turn. Give yourself or a friend a treat and sign up for a membership with Red Ice and help spread the word. Support a program dedicated to bring you vital information in these dark times. We go all across the board and do our very best to give you a variety of subjects that is interesting, important, and hopefully uplifting and positive as well. Go to redicecreations.com and read more. Next up on Red Ice Radio, we have Bob Frisell, Carl Munk, Mark Passio, Asharia S., Anthony Peake, Andrew Goff, Joseph Atville, Sonia Barrett, Josh Reeves, Dean Clifford, Barbara Hanklau, Håkan Blomqvist, and Paul Levy. Full schedule, so much important material that we want to bring to you. Keep listening, we'll be back after a short break.